From the Findlay Toyota Studios, it's Cofield and Company.
Welcome to the Hotel Hell. Check-in time is now, check-out time is never.
Does my room have cable?
No. And the sheets are made of fire.
Adam Hill.
Now, young man, what do you want to do with your life?
Actually, Matt, I kind of want to be a writer.
Well, la-di-frickin-da! We got ourselves a writer here!
Adam Candy.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for him.
Chrissy Paradis.
This place is crushing my soul.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
Sir, one more outburst, I will strangle you with my microphone wire. You understand me?
Friday afternoon here, Cofield and Company. Adam Candy, Adam Hill, Chrissy's here. Steve's not here. He's not going to yell at me today. It's going to be a better Friday. Amen to that. Oh, man. Adam, these are the days I love. These are the days I love, man. Like, it started out at about 9 or 10 in the morning looking like your average old Friday. And then the news storm just started dumping from the sky, man. Like, we just started getting a little bit of everything. The NBA went nuts on us. What in the world is going on in L.A.? All the Lakers news. That's coming up in just a little bit. 3:15, we're going to talk some Lakers. Might even bring you into the discussion here on Cofield and Company, but got to start with Game 2, Golden Knights and Sharks. You know, it's coming up tonight from San Jose. I don't know, you could choose to take the panic route after Game 1 if you want. I don't think it's necessary. I think you have to remember there was a point in this game where the Golden Knights are a post away from making it 3-2, and the Sharks feeling a hell of a lot of pressure in the second period of this game. So, Adam, over the last 48 hours, what have you heard developing around the Golden Knights in response to Game 1?
I think certainly, as you said, no panic. That's one thing that you've seen from the two media availabilities since that game. Nobody's freaking out or stressing out about anything, at least outwardly. I think internally there has got to be at least some concern about the fact that they coasted home for the last, you know, month plus, and were hoping to just flip a switch and turn it on and get ready and play, and they weren't able to, and that the Sharks kind of did the same thing, but they were able to. So, you know, you can, there's a lot of things you can point to, but you wouldn't be able to say, well, they've been playing competitive games and we haven't, and they had an advantage in Game 1. Like, they were both in the same position, and the Sharks were able to do what they wanted to do, and the Knights weren't. And not only were they not able to do what they wanted to do in terms of flipping a switch, they had, you know, a couple of keys to the series that they kept talking about over and over again, and they basically just bombed out on all of them. Like, they went 0-for on all their key points. So there's got to be some concern around the Golden Knights. And, you know, I've mentioned it a couple times, and, you know, I know people are, you know, not happy with it, and they're you know, they think it's ridiculous, but there's got to be concern about Marc-Andre Fleury as well. There has to be. Like, I know that it's very possible he comes out and shuts out the Sharks and all is right in the world again. But listen, it's now 6 straight playoff games dating back to last year. His save percentage was under 90%. It's 3 straight games since he returned from 3 weeks off that he's given up 4 goals. There's a lot going on there. So I think there's certainly much, much bigger concerns than Marc-Andre Fleury. They weren't able to generate any kind of offensive pressure around the net against Martin Jones. That was a big key to the series. They did none of that. They wanted to stay out of the penalty box. They had one of their most undisciplined games of the year. They wanted to manage the puck well. They were turning it over left and right. It was everything that they said they wanted to do was a disaster, and there's much, much bigger problems than Marc-Andre Fleury. But I think there's at least some looking around saying, man, I don't know if he's in his top form right now. If he's not there to carry you, what is the next option? And, you know, again, it could happen in a couple hours. They take the ice, and Marc-Andre Fleury is Marc-Andre Fleury, and everything is right again. But it could also go out, and he could give up 4 again, and they could lose 4-2, and then where do you turn?
There was not a single area of the game in which the Golden Knights outplayed San Jose in Game 1, and we thought it was just an assumption that no matter what version of Marc-Andre Fleury showed up, that he was going to be better than whatever Martin Jones had. And Martin Jones, going with what you said, the Golden Knights did not generate enough chances to really test him. But in the handful of times that he was tested, Martin Jones was okay.
He was, but my contention was, and we talked about this a lot, is that he was able to settle into the game with five shots on goal in the first period. And he just got to sit back there and watch the game develop, and they got him a lead. And then they got two more goals. And yeah, then he did give up a goal right after they had got their third. But at that point, it's 3-1. He's comfortable. He's confident. There's no getting rattled when you're up 3-0 and you give up a goal, because you're like, all right, 3-1, we're still up 2. We're okay. And then they didn't get any more pressure on him again. So again, five shots in the second period. So yeah, they got some chances, and he answered the bell on the chances that he had to. But it was never in a situation where he could really start getting in his head. And I think that's the key to the series for the Golden Knights. They weren't able to do that at all.
So now we talk carryover, because we can talk about it for Marc-Andre Fleury, and we can talk about it for Martin Jones. And we can ask, first of all, we have to ask, is Marc-Andre Fleury healthy? We don't know, and we won't know until this season is over. But we do have to look at it and say, does a bad game for Marc-Andre Fleury in Game 1 carry over to Game 2 any more than does a relatively good game for Martin Jones carry over into Game 2? Because you talk about the idea of him being able to settle in Game 1. Is there anything to settling into a series, or can an early Golden Knights goal, someone nets one in 5 minutes, does that rattle Martin Jones? Does that settle things back in the way everyone expected this series to play out?
I don't know if we know that, but I think you have to do everything you can to try to find out, obviously. And you know, it's funny because I talked to a lot of players, you know, the couple days leading up to the playoff series about the struggles that Martin Jones has had, not only this season, because, you know, we've talked about it, but I'll rehash it, that, you know, 16 starting goaltenders in the NHL playoffs, he was 16th in almost every category. From the big ones, you know, save percentage, goals against average, all those things, but also, you know, on shots from the slot, on, you know, on just any kind of, you know, category you could put together, on shots from the blue line, on different, and there was like one that he was, you know, 11th of the 16 or whatever, but almost everything, he was last in the league among starting goaltenders in the playoffs. And, you know, he had struggled throughout the year, but even more than that, he had struggled at the beginning of periods. He had given up a goal in the first 5 minutes of a period in like 53 or 58 games or something like that. So early in periods, he had struggled. Early in games, he had struggled. And against the Golden Knights, he had struggled. Four times in 13 starts before Game 1, he had been pulled for ineffectiveness when he played against the Knights. So, you know, you talk to players leading up to the series, and I would, you know, ask almost every player in the locker room, how much emphasis is there on getting in front of Jones, getting a goal early, getting in his head and doing that? And they would kind of laugh and say, yeah, of course there is. You want to get in his head, you want to do that, but you're always trying to score right away in the game. You're always trying to score on every shift, which is absolutely true. I mean, that's an obvious statement. But at the same time, you think and say, yeah, I mean, I think you do want to put pressure on him. You do want to get in his head, and you do want to score an early goal, but that's always the goal in a game. So I don't think they change anything necessarily, but they've got to find a way to at least make him make plays and think about some things.
The most interesting stat I saw researching this series on Martin Jones, his first 36 playoff games had a .931 save percentage. Into the series against the Golden Knights last year, .895. And we know how bad he's been since then.
Yeah.
This would be one hell of a time for Martin Jones to figure it out and to get back to what he had been previously. So the Golden Knights don't have a must-win tonight. I feel strongly about that. You're coming home after two. You don't have to win this game tonight. But another game that looks like Game 1, and I think there are some serious questions about the team, because you mentioned it, they did not come out strong. They really didn't have a lot of life until the second period. And so we have a Golden Knights team that probably tonight faces one of the more dicey moments in its brief franchise history.
Yeah, and you know, I think you're right that it's not a must-win. But what it is, if you lose it, then games 3 and 4 are must win.
No
question.
That's
the situation you're putting yourself in. That if you go out and I think all they have to do is play well, get some confidence going, get some things, you know, flowing in the right direction. Even if they lose, I mean, they obviously don't want to lose. But if you lose, but you play well, you start to say, okay, we're back in the series. We're okay. It's not over. But then you are putting a ton of pressure on yourself to win games 3 and 4 here at T-Mobile Arena. So you want to go out. Listen, they haven't lost anything yet. The goal when you start the series on the road is to split. You want to split those first two games. Obviously, you'd love to win them both. But you go on the road thinking, hey, let's go split. They've still got a chance to do that. So if they win tonight, everything from the other day is out the window, and it's a whole new series for them.
Final thought for now, because we're going to talk a lot more Golden Knights as we go along on the show. 3:30, We've got Craig Button from TSN coming in to talk, but not only Golden Knights Sharks, but the rest of the NHL playoffs. But final thought for now, there might not be a team other than what was the Washington Capitals coming into last year that has more in their own heads about the way a playoff series can fall apart than the San Jose Sharks, with the history that the San Jose Sharks have. Even a win tonight for the Golden Knights still brings all those questions, especially from dirty media types like us, back into play for the San Jose Sharks. UNLV and UNR both making news today in basketball.
I wonder if that's coincidental on UNLV's part.
Man, I wonder if they just wanted to desperately get to who their assistant coaches are right here and now today because nothing else was going on. But right now, as we speak, up at Lawler Events Center, they got the pipe and drape up. They got chairs down on the floor. They have the usual partisan crowd cheering on their new head coach, Steve Alford. 10-year contract for Steve Alford. 10 years! And he will not make as much as TJ Otzelberger until the fourth year of that contract. There's some massive buyouts built into this as well. Steve Alford says that he wants to be in Reno for the rest of his career. Okay, well, you know, Steve Alford also signed a 10-year extension at New Mexico and 3 days later left for UCLA. So let's not get too into the whole 10-year contract deal for Steve Alford. But on the UNLV side, TJ Otzelberger announces his assistant coaches, and he kind of did a nice job of touching all of the buckets, right? He goes for DeMarlo Slocum. He gets a guy who comes from the Pac-12 who has the roots in Las Vegas at El Dorado. He goes for Kevin Kruger. We all kind of saw that one coming, the relationship with Lon Kruger, the history that Kevin Kruger has playing here at this school. And he goes for Tim Buckley, a guy who's got some big-time recruiting experience from the Big 12. Who made the bigger basketball news in the state today, Adam?
Well, I mean, I think it was Reno, certainly on a national level. That, you know, Steve Alford is a name, and it's also, I think, I'm not going to say controversial, but it's certainly polarizing in terms of, is it a good hire or not? There's plenty of debate for, you know, is Steve Alford the right coach? Is his awfulness as a person balanced out by the fact that he, you know, has won games in this conference before and can be successful? You know, all of those things, I think, make it interesting and make it a storyline. The UNLV side announcing the assistant coaches, first of all, we kind of knew, we had a sense of where this was going, but at the same time, like, it's you just look at it and say, oh, they did a good job. Oh, that's a nice staff. Put together a good staff, a good mix of, you know, young and experienced and recruiting in different areas and Las Vegas ties and everything else. And you just look at the UNLV news and say, hey, good work. Good effort out on the recruiting trail as far as bringing in coaches. And now, you know, let's see what they can do recruiting themselves as they get out there and try to bring in players. So that's just an interesting, you know, announcement. I think it was very well timed to coincide with just before UNR made their announcement. But, you know,
hold on. We gotta hold up here. I don't know if we've got do we have the breaking news siren, Chrissy? Do we have the breaking news siren? It's happening right now on your television from Augusta, Georgia. We have breaking golf course marshal news from Augusta, Georgia. Tiger Woods was hitting from damn near in the woods at I believe, 15. Tiger Woods has a gallery like the Tiger Woods of old. And that gallery, as soon as he hit the shot, was trying to run in and get a look at what Tiger Woods had hit from all the way on the left on that hole. And as that was happening, as the gallery was coming and the marshals were trying to hold everybody back, it is a wet and rainy day at Augusta National, and here comes Sparky the marshal. He's going to save Tiger Woods from those onrushing onlookers. Oh, no, what happened? Oh, my God. Oh, my God, what happened? He went sliding into Tiger Woods' right ankle, and Tiger turned his ankle, and he's grimacing right now out in the middle of the fairway, shaking out his ankle.
He's looking over at the guy like, what are you doing, bro?
And Sparky the Marshal has now officially been fired from Augusta National. He has been kicked off the course. He will get no pimento cheese sandwiches. Sparky the Marshal is done for the tournament.
What
no
the
question
hell is
about
going
it.
On? I have no idea.
That is absolutely right, Stephen A.
Can you imagine if Tiger has to pull out of this tournament?
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Did you play any Tiger futures?
I did not.
Okay, well, you would have been pretty pissed off right now if you had. So Stephen A. just came in to ask us what the hell was going on. What the hell is going on with the Los Angeles Lakers, everyone? What is happening? with the Lakers. Luke Walton is out. LeBron's getting the band back together. We want to hear what you think about it. 364-1100, 364-1100. Lakers on the other side here on Cofield & Company.
It's Cofield & Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
But it's not this clean, ladies and gentlemen. If Magic Johnson has walked away, there is something going on. I don't know if LeBron has something to do with it or not, but something ain't right. Something ain't right. And damn it, it's time that we find out.
Stephen A. Smith, private investigator, gonna get down to the bottom of it. Putting on his fedora and his trench coat.
We're going to find out.
Talking to some pinup ladies in the dark. He's going to find out exactly what happened, and he knows there's something going on in this town that no one wants you to know about with the Los Angeles Lakers.
Is there really a mystery?
There is not a mystery in the slightest.
No.
Because Luke Walton is out. Like the bye-bye-bye, Chrissy, I think he kind of got the Joey Fatone treatment. So we have a question for you. I have a question for those of us in the studio to start with.
NSYNC or Backstreet Boys, that's an easy one. We've discussed this ad nauseum.
Good try, but it's not that. I'm going to have to get a little more personal than that. And did you know there was a question more personal than NSYNC or Backstreet Boys?
No, but I'm very out front that it's NSYNC all day and Backstreet Boys suck.
I mean, it's kind of like the Sharks and the Golden Knights where you say one team could be better than the other, but because you have Marc-Andre Fleury, you're supposed to be that much better. Justin Timberlake is your Marc-Andre Fleury, and he wins it all by himself.
Well, also, NSYNC is an R&B group, and Backstreet Boys are a pop band, so it's very different.
I'm going to leave the programming decisions to the other side of the building here, but my question to you was, have either of you ever, and you have to have used these words specifically, have either of you ever parted ways with a significant other? Or have you broken up with them or been broken up with?
You and your special
friend have never said to each other, you know what? I'm not sure this is working. I think we need to part ways.
Correct. I've never said that.
Not in those words.
You've had something more toward mutual though, Adam.
Yeah, like it was actually a decision of we both are trying to get careers started and like it's not really working.
Okay.
So we probably should try to figure out ourselves in our careers.
Okay.
And I think it worked out well, hopefully.
Well, I think that right there is exactly what just happened with the Los Angeles Lakers. They both want to get their careers going in a different way. Luke Walton does not want to have the entire city of Los Angeles and entirety of Team LeBron hating him. He wants to go up to Sacramento, take De'Aaron Fox and a young core, and go running. And the Los Angeles Lakers, well, they'd like to get going with the LeBron era pretty damn quickly here because they have to otherwise. But this whole mess of they parted ways. They didn't part ways. Someone got fired, and Luke Walton got fired. Just stop it.
But the thing is, Luke Walton got fired by LeBron, which is a very weird, like, it's not his employer doing it. It's one of his basic, what is essentially supposed to be, and I know the NBA is different, but essentially his employee having too much power and saying, yeah, I don't like the boss. The boss is out.
I'm going to let Steve Kerr do the talking for just about all of us at this point. Here was Steve Kerr asked about Luke Walton after practice today. They're losing one of the best human beings in the NBA. They're losing a guy who knows the game as well as anybody I've ever met. They're losing somebody who players believe in and players want to play for. But again, he was dependent on circumstances just like all of us. I feel for Luke. I feel fortunate to have the set of circumstances here where we've got wonderful people stabilizing our organization every day. That is the verbal subtweet from Steve Kerr on LeBron. I mean, just say it. You're Steve Kerr. You can get away with it. You talk about politics every day. You talk about Trump and everything else that you want to opine on. Just say it. LeBron got him fired.
Well, don't you think Steve Kerr wants a part in Space Jam?
Steve Kerr could be the coach in Space Jam, couldn't he?
Either he could coach the Monstars or the Toon Squad, actually. But I think maybe he's auditioning at this point. He doesn't want to burn that bridge.
Kerr versus Pop? Can we have Kerr versus Pop on the sidelines here?
Pop is definitely the Monstars.
Yeah.
coach.
As some, I don't
know
about
like
you.
No soul. It's very weird.
I have had my head bitten off in the bowels of what was America West Arena in Phoenix by our good friend Greg Popovich for cutting in on what he thought was an exclusive interview with a local TV station because I was standing there taking quotes because I'd missed his avail because I was in the Suns locker room.
Okay.
Come on, Pop. I didn't deserve it. I was a kid. Don't do that to a kid.
Did he stop the interview?
He actually did. He stopped in the middle of a TV interview, looked over at me and one other poor soul standing there in the hallway and said, you know, this is an exclusive interview right here. I'm like, okay. And I just wandered my way the other way and got the hell out of there.
He was messing with you.
Well, you know, he messed with me effectively.
Was he saying anything important?
No, he lost. He lost. You know what? He was pissed that he lost to Todd freaking Day and the Phoenix Suns. Yeah, I'd be pissed
too.
Todd Day. What year was this? Shout out Todd Day. Look it up.
Todd Day, backcourt mate of Lee Mayberry at Arkansas?
40 minutes of hell. Nolan Richardson. Wow. You know it. Craig Button from TSN coming up here in just a moment, talking a little bit of Golden Knights Sharks and the rest of the NHL playoffs here on Cofield and Company.
It's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Backward pass, Erik Karlsson into the zone. Erik waits, bumped in the high slot. Down he goes. Burns shoots, score! Brent Burns off the right post and into the goal. It's a 2-0 San Jose lead.
Great to Dan Duva, the Golden Knights. Golden Knights, of course, drop game one up in San Jose. They get the series fired back up here tonight at SAP Center, and we're going to talk about that series and a little more NHL beyond right now with Craig Button. Craig, you have one of the cooler words I've ever seen in a Twitter bio, opinionista. I like that. Is that original?
Well, I mean, we're all trying to offer opinions, so why not have a little fun with it, right?
There you go. You're your TSN opinionista, and you talked after game one about how the San Jose Sharks defense really stood out in game one against the Golden Knights. Why were they so effective?
Well, I mean, they've been effective all year long. And you know, Burns, Carlson's back. He looked like, you know, he was ready to go. But, you know, Mark Edward Blast and Brendan Dillon and Justin Braun, I mean, they have been very, very strong this year. But here's what I will say about that. I mean, not only are they talented, which we know, but they're also able to have the confidence. They stay up in the neutral zone. They turn pucks over incredibly well, and then they transition quickly into the offensive zone. So what does that do for you? I mean, what it does is it saves the legs of some of those forwards on San Jose, so they're not always having to zip back into your own zone defensively, and they can break up plays and not allow like a thrust of offensive play to come at you. So, you know, they're good at it, they're confident, they're daring at times, but it's something they excel in. And, you know, it's the way they play, but they also have the capability because of their skating and their thinking to take advantage of those things. And it's a real challenge for teams to play against them, including the Vegas Golden Knights.
Well, what can the Knights do to kind of turn that around a little bit? Because I know Pete DeBoer talked about coming into the series how much the Golden Knights forwards play them up, you know, when they're on the blue line in the offensive zone, and it creates some space in front of the net, and the Sharks want to take advantage of that. We certainly saw that on the Evander Kane goal. There was just wide open space for him to operate. But what can the Knights do to kind of change and not let the Sharks defense impact the game so much?
Well, what I think they have to do is, and if we go back, I think what you have to do is you have to be able to come underneath with speed through the out of the defensive zone. And then make sure that you can make a quick pass either wide or to another player is going through the middle. The Montreal Canadiens in a game in March went into San Jose, and I thought they really set a template for how to beat the San Jose Sharks and beat that pressure. They didn't win the game, but they carried significant portions of that game with respect to using their speed and their quickness. But if you try to stretch San Jose's defense, they're too good. They break it up. I think you have to work them, like come at them in what I call a double layer. You gotta come with speed, force them to come into a spot, and then jump into the open ice with speed. And now you're going to back them up. And I think that's a strategy that if you want to try to attack the Vegas or the San Jose Sharks and back them up, I think that's what you have to do.
How concerned were you with the Golden Knights' performance coming out of Game One?
Yeah, I don't know. Concerned is the right word. I think what I would say is that one of the things we've seen with the Golden Knights this year is swings in play. Some swings where they had stretches where they didn't win, and then some stretches where they did win and it didn't seem like they could lose. Quite frankly, going into the playoffs, they were a team that hadn't been playing very well. So for me, the Vegas Golden Knights have to find this level of consistency when it's been there and they've been successful. It's been very, very good. But when it hasn't been there, and that's what they had going into the playoffs, they look like a very pedestrian team. So I think they got to find their game with respect to, what gave them success when they were winning those games and really try to take advantage of those areas. One of the things I think people in Vegas have to remember with the Golden Knights, this isn't as fast a team as they were last year. They don't have Eric Halla, and Max Pacioretty and Paul Stastny and Mark Stone will be in very good players. They're not fast. So this team has lost a real element of speed that was a real asset to them last year. So, you know, how they move the puck up the ice and how they attack, I mean, these become really important aspects to consider that you got a different group because it's not the same group.
Yeah, because it feels like once, especially that second line you just mentioned, Pacioretty and Snasty, once they get their gravity set up in the offensive zone, it's very hard to get them out of there, but you got to be able to break through and get there in the first place. Three games back now for Marc-Andre Fleury, and he has allowed 12 goals in the last two regular season games and the first playoff game combined. You've been watching Marc-Andre Fleury for a long time. Does he look right to you right now?
Yeah, I would say yes. It's a tricky question and not one that, when I say that, that's not on you. It's watching him play and, you know, one of the things that when you're a goaltender, you want some kind of order in front of you. And at times, if you don't have that order in front of you, then you start to feel like, okay, what else is going on here? What else do I need to be aware of? You know, where's the other challenges? So, I think that when you get back into the net, you want to get to that comfort zone. I still think he's trying to find that. But in terms of his movement and reading the play and competing around the net, I think he's just fine, but I think finding that rhythm, is where he's at right now, trying to find just that level where, okay, I got this all, it just becomes second nature.
I want to ask a question about Nikita Gusev, only because the Golden Knights land is freaking out right now about the potential of adding somebody with that much talent coming in at this time, but can you really just throw a guy into the mix in the playoffs and say, hey, go out there and help us out?
Well, what I would say is Nikita's a very skilled, very gifted player. And so when you start to when you try to give an opportunity to a player, and there's other smart players with the Golden Knights. So he's older, he's mature, he's played in the Olympics, he's played in KHL, high-end games, playoff games. So, you're not dealing with a young player. And to me, when you have that potential to add that type of a player, to add just the opportunity to put a little more skill in your lineup, I think it's a risk well worth taking. And I'm not so sure it's a risk. Nikita's very smart. He understands how to make plays. He understands how to attack. And, you put everything into context. You know, if you're looking for more skill, don't look at what could go wrong. What could go right? And I quite frankly, I think a lot could go right by putting Nikita Gusev into the lineup.
Talking to Craig Button from TSN, a little bit of Vegas Golden Knights, San Jose Sharks, but a little bit of the rest of the NHL playoffs as well. And Craig, I have to tell you, when I saw Tampa up 3-0 on Columbus, I kind of tuned out. I kind of turned my attention away to other games. And to come back later and see what happened in that game, I know I was surprised, but I have to imagine the Tampa Bay Lightning and their fans were even more surprised.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question they were, and I think when you go back and you look at it and you consider, they were up 3-0, they could have been up 4-0, save for a great Bobrovsky save on Nikita Kucherov. But then you start, Vasilevsky was just okay. Hedman and McDonough were so subpar; they were terrible. Kucherov points and Stamkos no points. The power play was terrible. This was a game where absolutely the Tampa Bay Lightning did not play to their level. You know, the Columbus Blue Jackets now have a lot of confidence, and you know, certainly, you know, based on what they came back, and it might be tougher. But if you look at the Tampa Bay Lightning, this team is too good, and they are able to do so many things. And when you look at what they didn't do in Game 1, I don't think there's any reason for anybody to be in a panic mode with the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Is it time to panic in Winnipeg? Because I don't know if Winnipeg is good anymore.
Well, I mean, when you look at the record, I think they're 16-17-3 in their last 36 games. And you look at the St. Louis Blues, conversely, who have been lighting it up and have been very strong. If I'm the Winnipeg Jets, I'm thinking to myself, we played really well for two periods in Game 1. And third period, the St. Louis Blues just took it right over and overwhelmed them. And, you know, if you're Paul Maurice, like, is that as good as we can play? But more importantly, what do we have to do to beat this St. Louis team? Because right now, that third period has to sit in their heads with the idea that, like, we are really, really have some challenges in front of us. And I think that's where the Winnipeg Jets find themselves. And, you know, I said this before the playoffs started. I thought the worst matchup possible for the Winnipeg Jets was the St. Louis Blues. I think that's going to prove to be the case. I don't see Winnipeg being able to beat St. Louis.
Who is the best team in the West? I feel like San Jose is when they're healthy, but we saw last night Calgary get good goaltending, and when they get good goaltending, they could be the best team as well.
Well, they could be, and you know, the other thing too, you got to consider about San Jose. You know, their Achilles heel is Martin Jones. I mean, he's had a subpar year, and that's another area where you talk about Vegas trying to get into the offensive zone and root in there and make sure that they don't back out of there. Those are areas, and then test Martin Jones, because I think that based on what he's done over the course of the season, he's a real vulnerability for the Sharks. But when they are playing well and they are on top of their game and Martin Jones doesn't give them subpar goaltending, I agree with you. I think they're a very good team, and certainly a team that can contend for the Stanley Cup.
We're very excited about Toronto and Boston. Are we going to get a fun series out of that, or is Toronto going to turn this on and just kind of blow them out?
No, I think they'll be a good team. I mean, Boston's a good team. I think that Boston has their own challenges with respect to, you know, Toronto's quick and fast, and I think that the Boston Bruins are going to have to find a way to not be a victim to that, and they're going to have to find a way. You know, one of the things with Toronto is with Tavares, Matthews, and Kadri up the middle of the ice, it's a real advantage for them. And I think for Bruce Cassidy and the Boston Bruins, that, you know, that's going to be the task at hand, trying to find a way to deal with that, what I call the three-headed monster at center ice. But Boston's a good team, and, you know, I don't think this is going to be a four-game sweep. But Toronto, I think, by winning Game 1 and winning it in the manner in which they did in Boston, you know, was significant for them in terms of showing, hey, listen, we're a team that needs to be reckoned with.
One more question here for Craig Button from TSN before we let you go. I'm going to turn it all the way to later in the summer and talk draft for just one moment. A question for you about the top of the draft with the New Jersey Devils. Is Jack Hughes the only choice, or do you think that Kako has enough momentum to get into that number one spot?
See, to me, I don't think it's about momentum. I think it's about who has the best skills. I think Jack Hughes is superior to every single player in this draft when it comes to skills, high-end skills. He's electrifying. He does things with his feet, his hands, and his head that no other player in this draft can do. And as good as Kaapo Kakko is, I'm not sure he's better than Vasily Podkolzin. I think Vasily Podkolzin is a very good player. But in my mind, you know what? You talk about momentum, and everybody talks about Kakko breaking records. Let me just tell you, Jack Hughes has set every record in terms of points at the National Team Development Program. Let's just name four players whose records he's broken. That would be Bill Kessel, Patrick Kane, Jack Eichel, and Austin Matthews. So if you want to just put it onto records, I think that Jack Hughes can hold his own to Capo Caco. But to me, it's not about that. It's not about momentum. He, in my mind, in my view, he's superior to every player in the skill areas, and that's what it's about.
Well, I'll tell you what, Craig. As a New Jersey Devils fan, that is the passionate defense of Jack Hughes that I wanted to hear, because I believe that's the right way for them to go as well. Craig, we really appreciate the time, and we're looking forward to another great slate of NHL action tonight. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. Have a good day.
Thanks, man. Great stuff.
Appreciate Craig Button from TSN joining us. More Golden Knights, more Rebels, more Steve Alford up in Reno. Is he really making less than TJ Otzelberger? Looks that way.
Bring it.
It's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
I'm being silent for a moment. I don't want to get kicked out of the gallery. I don't want to be one of those patrons, Tiger Woods.
Get it close, Tiger.
From about 30 feet on 16. That's a good lag.
Tap in for Bert par.
Tiger will par. Birdie's on two of the last three. Golf voice engaged.
What's been frustrating? Because
it's a
faux shizzle.
I mean, I'm just glad he recovered from the Marshall.
Sparky the Marshall. If you did not catch it about 15 minutes ago, Sparky the Marshall trying to, in theory, protect Tiger Woods from the rushing Augusta patrons who we know were definitely going to, I don't know, tackle Tiger. What are they going to do to him? Nothing worse than Sparky losing his grip on the wet grass and going full sliding into third base into Tiger's ankle and turning his right ankle. It didn't slow Tiger down, despite parring 13, which might as well be a bogey. Came back with birdies at 14, 15, pretty close on that putt at 16. And that lets me get into some statistics about the Masters. Yes, we teased a little Steve Alford, a little UNLV basketball. We're going to talk to Jeff Grammer, come to us live from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Spent just a bit of time around Steve Alford over his time covering the New Mexico Lobos. But right now you have a multiple-time Masters champion who is three shots off the lead, and we are all losing our stuff over it. Of course, I am talking about Phil Mickelson.
No, definitely not Phil Mickelson.
Is a multiple-time Masters champion who is three shots off the lead.
Nobody cares about
but
him.
But we don't care. We don't care at all about Phil Mickelson, who's won three Masters championships. We care about LT Gray, who has won four Masters championships and is two shots off the lead. I took a little poetic license to make my bad joke work. All right, Adam, we've had almost two full rounds to watch Tiger. And I think the thing you can safely say watching Tiger is that the Tiger of the last couple of years that we watched, where it just didn't look like he had the juice to keep up with the younger guys, it didn't look like he was going to be able to putt well enough, it just didn't look like he was on the same level as these guys. Not the level of old Tiger, because forget that, it's gone. Old Tiger is gone. He is dead and buried. Don't go looking for him. But this version of Tiger that we've seen looks to be on the level with the rest of the guys he's competing with. This version of Tiger can win the Masters.
This version of Tiger looks, I was going to say, somewhat healthy, except for the ankle now.
Thanks, Sparky.
Sparky took him out on that straight red card slide tackle way late. It was ridiculous.
Professional foul.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I've always been an unashamed, unabashed Tiger fan. I'm obsessed with Tiger. I'll only watch if Tiger's in contention, so I'm all in for the weekend as long as he stays where he is, and I'll be cheering for him. But, yeah, he looks healthy, and he just talked the other day about, you know, being at the Champions Dinner 2 years ago and believing his career was over and that he was never going to be able to compete at a high level again because of his back, and had some procedures done. And I think the biggest thing watching him is, yes, you're excited, and, yes, it looks like he's back to playing not Tiger level but at a very elite level among the best in the world. But you just have this feeling of, like, which swing is going to hurt his back, and then he, you know, can't compete at that level the next 2 days? Or, you know, is something going to happen where, you know, he falls off, or he just can't continue it and keep it up? And you just never had that feeling when Tiger was at his peak, when he was great. It was just he was going to close it out. He's going to win. It was just how much is he going to win by? But now I when I watch, I just keep, like, dreading that one swing where he kind of grimaces after he hits it, and he's like, ah, you know, I can't hit the next couple drives. Got to play the irons now because I can't swing my driver.
And that is what he has in his hands, actually, at the moment, swinging from 17T. Tiger Woods.
He likes it. Just picked up the tee.
He grabbed it. You reached down for that tee. Don't hurt your back picking up the tee. Don't do that. To me, this version of Tiger Woods, in a different way, he came about a much different path than the guy I'm about to mention, but we're at the point now where this is Act 2 of Tiger Woods, almost like Act 2 of LeBron, in this way of version Miami of LeBron, post-decision. I didn't like the guy. We were tired of the dominance. We were tired of the idea that this guy was fated to win. He had Wade, he had Bosch, but the point is it was LeBron's team. And LeBron was pretty much the guy to go chase, the guy to go get. And that's how it felt with Tiger for years. We know that. We know that when it got to Sunday, you could enjoy the dominance, and you could say, this is something like we've never watched before. But there was a little something boring by the time we got to Sunday, and it even was a two-shot lead for Tiger Woods, because you just said it. There was no way he was letting it go. This version of Tiger, for me, is a lot easier to root for. I know you're a big fan. You've always been a big fan. But I can root for this version of Tiger so much easier than I could the old version, because some of the mean mugging and stare you down and cockiness is gone, but none of the game that made Tiger good is gone. The physical ability, obviously, has changed. The back has changed that. I just find it a lot easier to root for this Tiger the same way I found it a lot easier to root for Cleveland LeBron. Second round, LeBron.
Can I just completely come over the top on the analogy, though? Because I like the basketball analogy to it. I think this is Wizards Jordan.
Wow.
Like, there was early Jordan. Like, Jordan with the Bulls was just dominant. He was going to win every year. That's just going to happen. That's what it's going to be. Tiger struggles, like the parking lot incident with the wife and the DUI and all the craziness and the affairs and everything, that's baseball Jordan.
Ah.
And now this is Wizards Jordan, where he might go out and give you 36, 37, and he might even be able to carry you to some wins, but you just don't get the feeling he's that same dominant player anymore.
Wizards Jordan was pretty diminished, man. Like, Wizards Jordan.
He'd go for like a 40-point game. You're like, where did that come from?
That's true. And we always were kind of waiting for that to pop out, and also for how is this version of Jordan going to break apart?
He was also like a fadeaway jumper and like 3-point shooting Jordan at that point.
The driver was gone.
He had to change his game completely.
He was no longer a driver. Tiger Woods no longer has the driver in much the same way. Tiger Woods right now has two holes to play. We know he's going to go into the weekend in contention. Right now, you are looking at a 5-way tie atop the leaderboard.
What if he goes to 12th spot on the 18th?
He's not.
Don't say that. Don't jinx
us. Not putting up a 12.
You're going to rob us of the weekend?
He could go nothing but putter and not put a 12 up on 18.
All right, well, you say that now. Keep that tape, Chrissy. Mark this time.
That's fine. You have me down for 100 on the No Van de Velde for Tiger Woods at the 18th at Augusta today. You're looking at a tie at the top right now of Francesco Molinari, Brooks Koepka, Adam Scott, Louis Oosthuizen, Jason Day. You're looking at multiple guys with green jackets on this leaderboard right now. Obviously, we mentioned Tiger. Phil is in contention as well. So you're going to have some must-see TV over the weekend. For the Masters, always got the one week a year that I miss being a golf writer. I was at Augusta in 2005. It was Tiger at the 16th. I was standing about 50 yards away when that ball hit the lip, and he and Stevie came bouncing up to get a look, and the roar that went through was like one of those physical audio things where like you feel it hit you in the chest. That was one of the most amazing things sports-wise that I've ever been around. And Augusta, I see you. I always see you.
Overrated.
We'll leave that alone. Jeff Grammer from Albuquerque joining us to talk Steve Alford and the new Nevada Wolfpack head coach in just a moment here on Cofield & Company.